1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6, wherein ye greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, ye are in heaviness through manifold temptations, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise, honor, and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. So there's no doubt that this passage is one of those passages that we should come back to over and over again. If we were to narrow down life to a very, very basic, fundamental level, there are really only two ways to approach life: the life of faith or the life of unbelief. Really, that is where the rubber meets the road. There are only two choices we have. Do you agree? Either a life of faith or a life of unbelief. That is, most people out there, and unfortunately most Christians, choose to live the life of unbelief. And that is a life that people live by default, even if they don't choose anything. By default, they are living a life of unbelief. People revert to this life automatically. That's what I mean by default. Even after becoming Christians, this life of unbelief is more popular. It is a more popular choice to make. And why is that? Because the life, here it is, the life of unbelief is easy. The life of unbelief is easy. It's more feeling-oriented. The life of unbelief is more feeling-oriented. And the life of unbelief is more self-centered. So we can see why the masses love the life of unbelief. They don't like to do hard things. They like to do easy things. We can see why it's popular among Christians, because most Christians hate to suffer for Christ's sake. For Christ's sake. They hate to do things that they're told to do. And that is why people choose to live the life of unbelief. They hate to do anything that they don't want to do. They love self-preservation. They love self-centeredness. And even if one doesn't confess that their choice is a life of unbelief, it can be seen in their actions and behavior, in their choices, and how they treat other people, and in the way they talk. This life of unbelief is a very superficial life. It is a very surface life, and it is an immoral, dishonest kind of life. And like I said, people in churches can resort to this kind of life. And I have seen it over and over again. And as a preacher, as a pastor, it is very, very sad to see, especially when people have been under the teaching of such amazing truth for years. And they just stop living by faith. And that is the life of an unbeliever. Christians can and do become this way. They may begin very well, but they begin to believe the lies of the devil, the deceptions of the devil. Obeying the things written down in the Bible no longer become important to them. Now, keep in mind what biblical faith is. The key phrase in the verse that I read this morning is your faith. Your faith. And what does biblical faith mean? Biblical faith is focused. What is it focused on? Biblical faith is focused on things that will take place, are come to pass, when the Lord Jesus Christ returns. Okay, that's biblical faith. Biblical faith is focusing on the things that will happen when Jesus Christ returns. And this is why Peter says what he says, the trial of your faith is much more precious than gold that perishes. Your faith. Now obviously Peter here is talking to Christians, people who have faith. Your faith. We need to do everything we can to feed our faith. We need to do everything we can to protect our faith, to nurture our faith, to make our faith a priority. Your faith. That's what Peter writes. Your faith. Not God's faith, not someone else's faith, but your faith. That should be the most important thing about your life, the most important thing about anyone's life is their faith. Is their faith. It should be the defining attribute of your life as a Christian. Your faith. This is what makes us Christian people. This is what makes us different. This is what makes us different in how we look at life. This is how our marriages are different. This is how our single life is different. Different in how we deal with problems. Different in our relationships with one another. Your faith. Your faith. This is what makes us disciples of Jesus Christ who love one another. All the people mentioned in Hebrews 11, that incredible chapter of faith, all those people that are mentioned in that chapter lived by faith. And their faith is what saved them. It saved them. If they did not have faith, they would not have been saved. So faith made a difference. Faith made a difference in their lives. It will always make a difference in your life. Hebrews 11, and don't forget this, Hebrews 11 is a salvation chapter. It is dealing with salvation. Don't forget that. All the people mentioned in Hebrews 11 are going to enter the kingdom when Jesus Christ returns. And what made them different? What made them different? Their faith. Their faith. Were they perfect people? Were they people that did not have problems? They were not perfect people. Did they have problems? Yes, they did. But they were people who obtained salvation because they lived by faith and died in faith. That is their testimony. The whole chapter is preceded by the last verse in Hebrews 10:39. If you don't read Hebrews 10:39, you won't understand what chapter 11 is dealing with. That last verse in Hebrews 10:39, it's worded different in many English translations. Let me read it, a couple of English translations to you. This is the International Standard Version. Now we Christians do not belong to those who turn back and are destroyed, but to those who have faith and are saved. This is the last verse before Hebrews 11:1. Contemporary English Version. We are not like those people who turn back and get destroyed. We will keep on having faith until we are saved. Worded a little differently, but expresses the same point. Hebrews 10:39, New Jerusalem Bible. We are not the sort of people who draw back and are lost by it. We are the sort who keep faith until our souls are saved. Hebrews 10:39, New Living Translation. But we are not like those who turn away from God to their own destruction. We are the faithful ones whose souls will be saved. And then he launches right into chapter 11 and gives a list of examples of faithful ones. Faithful ones And they are not headed for destruction. They are headed for the experience of salvation when Jesus Christ returns. And they are examples put before us because we have a race to run. And these are people who did not settle for a life of unbelief. The life of unbelief is a superficial life. That is the way of the world. That is the way of worldly people. When you meet them, they live superficial lives. Were the people in Hebrews 11 ever tempted to go back, to turn back, as Hebrews 10:39 says, turn back to their own destruction? Absolutely were they. You better believe they were tempted. You better believe that they were people who were tempted to turn back, but they didn't. They didn't. They remained focused. They were not deceived by the devil's lie. It is guaranteed the longer you live as a Christian, the longer you serve Jesus, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, the more you're going to be tempted to turn back. All the more. And your faith will no longer be, as Peter says, precious. And all of a sudden, it won't be your priority anymore. Other things will come in. We've seen women in India, I've even seen it in America, where they have, when they have children, and then their life of faith is over. And their children become their gods. You know? And it's really a sad thing. I mean, we had that happen to someone here. You know, they were asking questions galore when they didn't have any baby on the scene. But when a baby come on the scene, you even never heard a question from their mouth ever again. They never at all participated in any of the conversations we had anymore. Before that, they were asking questions. They were seeking God. And man, when they had a baby, life was over for them. The life of faith was over for them. Because that baby became a test. To test their faith. And they failed. Your faith, when this happens, is no longer considered much more precious than gold that perishes. In fact, the things like gold, the temporal things, the people, all the things, what Peter is saying, all the things that perish, that becomes a person's focus. People perish. So if people become your focus and what they do, that is not the life of faith. That is not Christianity. And people are going to perish. We should never put our focus on people, whether they're in our own family, because they are perishing. We don't want to be Christians who draw back, as the writer of Hebrews says. People who have started well, but yet begin to live a superficial life. The life of an unbeliever. The unbeliever has a very different focus. This is the focus of the masses. They live life with a very limited perspective. So many things that we all fret over and worry about, in the light of the big picture, are not even worthy to be compared to it. In fact, Paul likens these things to dung when they're compared to Christ. Dung. The superficial life is a life, and this is what we see, the life that's occupied with self, for the most part, or with those things that are going on around them in their own little life. I'm so busy and this and that. And their own little pitiful world. They are people who don't want to suffer for Christ. And what do I mean by that? I don't mean that you're going to be thrown to the lions or anything like that. What do I mean by suffer for Christ? They don't want to die to self. They don't want to die to their own desires. They don't want to die to this world. Suffering for Christ has to do with what? Dying for Christ. Dying for Christ, for Christ's sake. We die to self for Christ's sake. Not for anyone else's sake. For Christ's sake. To have a godly marriage, a biblical marriage, we need to what? Die to ourselves. Really, the only way that people can have a biblical marriage is if they die to themselves. To have a godly church, close relationships in a godly church, you need to die to yourself. No one said forgiving someone is easy. I don't know who ever said that forgiving someone is easy. It's not. But it's for Christ's sake. It's for Christ's sake. Who are we serving? We're not serving us. It's not for my sake. It's not for that person's sake. It's for Christ's sake. Christ is my life. Right? So everything I do is for what? Christ's sake. So when I die to myself, it's for Christ's sake. You hear people that, and I don't understand it, and they say, well, I can't forgive. You are an unbeliever with a big U. Unbelievers don't forgive. It's true. God allowed someone to hurt you to test your faith, but unbelievers don't see God. So what happens to an unbeliever? They look at their little pitiful wound. They look at all their hurts. Problem? They don't see the big picture. They don't see the big picture. Unbelievers are known to be bitter people. No matter what they say on the face, they are bitter people and they are unforgiving people, and Christ won't forgive them either. He only forgives those who forgives others. That's what the Bible says. But true Christians are willing to suffer for Christ's sake. But the unbeliever, he wants to get his own way. That is an unbeliever. Putting forward their rights. That's unbelief. Unbelief. Putting forth one's rights. That's not Christian. Let me tell you, if an unbeliever is in a church, they are the most dangerous people. They are the most dangerous people. They will be people that are very hard to get along with. You will not be able to tell them anything because they think they know it all. And the pulpit counsel goes in one ear and out the other ear. They don't have the faith to see God speaking to them Sunday after Sunday after Sunday. They don't have faith. If we lose biblical focus, stop living by faith, when we are members of a church, we will be the cause of so many problems. And when a problem rises up, sure enough, you can always trace it back to unbelief. When a problem arises among Christians, you will always trace it back to people that are unwilling to suffer for Christ's sake. They're too busy about their own damn lives. And I've said that on purpose. You don't like it? Then there's the door. Because I'm preaching. And I mean business. I want your attention. Kids don't ever use the word. But I'm making a point. Problems will come about with people that don't live by faith. They will open their mouth in an unguarded way and say stupid things. They will become defenseless. They will hold grudges. They will be unforgiving. They will become what the Bible calls nitpickers. Do you have that saying here? A nitpicker? When I think of a nitpicker, I've seen actually in India nitpickers. Especially in the villages or in slums, the ladies are picking the hair, picking things out of the hairs of their children. You know, I also see it at the zoo sometimes, you know, when the monkeys are concentrating on that. Did I remember right? Yeah. This is what a nitpicker is. But a nitpicker really is a person that has lost focus. And they no longer see what? The big picture. And they are no longer carrying their cross daily. Nitpicking, I looked this up because it came to my mind. Nitpicking is when you start finding fault with others over little tiny things. That's called nitpicking. Don't do it. This is not Christian. This is not the way we learn Christ. This will kill a friendship. This will kill a church. Nitpicking means to be over-scrutinizing. Over-scrutinizing. Criticism over tiny details of a person's life. Examining excessively how people do things. That really, really, in the big picture, we're talking about the big picture, really, really, in the big picture, excessively examining how people do things that are in the big picture, unimportant. Really unimportant. It doesn't matter. Does that affect your life with Christ? Is the Lord still on the throne because you can't understand why people do certain things? Let me tell you, our church, because it's small, because it's very, very small, we have a very small, I tried to explain that to these people that were interested in our church. We're a very small church. Very small, because we have such a small church. We can disintegrate so fast. Boom. Nitpicking is a church killer. Let us be loyal to friendships. I heard a story one time about Jack Hiles. I don't agree with everything Jack Hiles did. Baptist preacher in Hammond, Indiana. And by the way, he used that word before in his pulpit. And not that I'm going to use it again. I probably won't ever use it again, but it was a point. Someone out in the parking lot one time said something about Jack Hiles, and a member of the church punched him. I mean, do I agree with that? No, but there's a bygone loyalty. There used to be something called loyalty. You know, I'm not all for blind loyalty, of course, but there is a certain loyalty that used to be around. A loyalty to friendship. I mean, we see the loyalty in marriage is just out the door. Someone said, this week I was talking, and they said, I don't know why people didn't like Bill Clinton. I thought he did a good job. And I said, you don't know why they didn't like President Bill Clinton? He had an affair with someone that wasn't his wife in the Oval Office of the United States of America? And you're wondering why people had a problem with him? I said, if he can't be loyal to his wife, how in the world can he be loyal to the country? He'll sell those secrets to the Chinese, right? How can we trust a man in office when he can't even be trusted with his wife? I got mad when I told him that. That's crazy. Because they said, well, just because they were, you know, immoral doesn't affect how good of a president they were. Oh, I said, you got to be kidding me. What do you think? Lying, cheating, bribery, stealing, all that stuff is immoral behavior. But there's a loyalty that, although I don't agree with punching people in the church parking lot, there was a loyalty to defend the church, to defend the members, defend the pastor. And if anyone you meet wants to nitpick at a member, tell them to shut up. Shut up. No matter how close they might be to you. I want my wife to tell me, shut up. If I nitpick, tell me to shut up. Shut up. And I'll have to accept it because I just preached it. Where is the loyalty today? You know where it is? It's lost in the little nitpicking. And we don't see the overall big picture. The big picture. We need to see the big picture. Your faith, here's the big picture. Your faith is much more precious. Your faith is much more precious than nitpicking. I mean, people of faith should have a different way of living because they have a holy calling. 2 Timothy 1:9, they have a heavenly calling in Hebrews 3:1. They have a high calling in Philippians 3:14. What are we here for? We're here in this life to do God's will. No matter what happens, no matter what comes our way, no matter what desires maybe go unfulfilled, whatever dreams might perish in the storms of life, we are here in the big picture to do God's will, to do the will of God. And we are being made into a certain kind of people. We are being made into a certain kind of person that's fit, that's being prepared for the worthy positions of the coming government of this earth, the coming kingdom of God. And that's the big picture. Think about the life of Jesus. Jesus was the perfect man who always kept the big picture in mind. He always kept that big picture in front of him. Think of all the suffering that he went through. The rejection. Think of the rejection that Jesus had for a moment. Think of the loneliness that Jesus experienced. Think of no one to talk to. Think of Jesus. Think of the pain. Think of the heartache. He was able to deal with all of these things because why? He lived by faith. His faith was precious, more precious than anything that this world could offer him. Out of all people, he was a person that was treated unfairly. He was wronged. Out of all people, he had the right to be offended. He had people call him names. They ruined his reputation. They called him a bastard, that he was born of fornication. Because no one knew who his father was. They gossiped about him. They called him a wine bibber, a drinker. They slandered him. They said he fellowships with all the prostitutes. And then one of the closest chosen apostles became a traitor and stabbed him in the back. Figuratively. And then he was killed in what others would say the prime of his life at 33 years old. He was killed. But you see, Jesus was different. Why? Jesus came into the world to do the will of God. That's what Hebrews 10:7 says. Lo, I come in the volume of the book. It is written of me to do thy will, O God. John 4:34, Jesus said to them, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. John 6:38, for I came down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him that sent me. And Hebrews 5:8, though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. So God's will for all of his sons and daughters in this life is that they would learn obedience. They would learn to live by faith through the things that they suffer. And that is the life of faith. Philippians 2:8 is the life of faith. This is what Jesus experienced. Being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. And I don't think Jesus today has any kind of regrets whatsoever for the life that he lived. He kept focus. He saw the big picture. And that is faith. Faith always sees everything that happens in light of the big picture. This reveals the measure of each of our maturity, really. Keeping things in the big picture. Is it hard to do? Yes, it is. Romans 8:29 is God's big picture. This is the big picture of God. Romans 8:29. For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his son, that he, that is Jesus' son, might be the firstborn among many brethren. Those powerful words there. Foreknow, predestinate. These are words of random chance or random coincidence. These are words of intelligent design. These are words of a planner, a plan. God is a planner. God's plan is for his elect people, the church people, to be conformed to the image of his son, to be the brethren, to be the close brethren with his son when his son returns to be the king over this earth. If we can see Romans 8:29 along with 1 Peter 1:7, in all these little things that go on in our lives, little things, they're really little things to be in the big, in the light of the big picture. But if we just look at it from our own little life, then it becomes this huge mountain and we make a big fuss over it. But in the big picture, the overall scheme of things, if we understand Romans 8:28 and 1 Peter 4:7, these small things that we think are really important, are not so important. And you know what? They kind of vanish away. They vanish away. The big picture, the ultimate reality. Peter writes, this is why he writes in 1 Peter 1:6, wherein ye greatly rejoice, now for a season, if need be, you are in heaviness through manifold temptations. I kind of want to break this verse down. Wherein, in the King James, other translations have in this. This wherein looks back to verses 3 through 5 in 1 Peter. And Peter spoke in those verses about a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. That's our hope, right? Because Jesus Christ rose from the dead. That's a living hope. We also hope to defeat death as he did. To be raised from the dead in the first resurrection. To have an inheritance in verse 4 that is reserved for us. And to have salvation that's ready to be revealed in verse 5. That is what wherein looks back to. Wherein looks back to 3 to 5. It's a future salvation. It's entering the kingdom. It's to have part in the first resurrection. Wherein are in this. Peter commands us not just to rejoice about this, but to greatly rejoice. Wherein? Greatly rejoice. We should be rejoicing over the big picture. Faith should be in us, and we should have our focus on those things, and we should greatly rejoice. This word means an intense, overwhelming feeling of delight. Peter is directing our attention to this life Peter is directing our attention in this life to God's overall plan for His elect. He's directing our attention to the things of faith. And faith rejoices over the things that we've been told about in the Bible that we haven't seen, the promises, but we have to wait for them in order to experience them. And there is joy in this forward look, this anticipation. Although we live in the present, where there are many valleys, there are many thorns, there are many bumps in the road when we travel down the road of life, our joy looks over all the valleys of despair to the hope that we have out ahead of us. The big picture. In view of these realities, we have a living hope. You know, when you read those passages, surely doesn't want to make us a nitpicker, does it? For goodness sakes, let's always keep our focus off of people. We have a living hope. Let us rejoice in that. Not just rejoice, but greatly rejoice in that. I mean, Jesus said, "Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad." Why? Abraham saw the big picture, and he rejoiced. Did Abraham go through trials and tribulations? Absolutely. But he rejoiced, Jesus said, to see my day. Faith was precious. Then Peter writes, "Though now for a season, if need be, you are in heaviness through manifold temptations." Peter is saying here that the reality of this world is that it is not always just fun and games. That there are going to be manifold temptations. What does that mean? The word temptation is better translated here as trials. And this speaks of outward circumstances. Circumstances usually that we have no control of. People that we have no control of. And these trials are going to come in many colors, many shapes, many sizes. King James says manifold temptations. New King James says various trials. NIV says all kinds of trials. And Basic Bible English says all sorts of trials and testings. The word manifold literally means many colored. These are the various trials that are going to be painful ordeals in our lives. And Peter writes, "You are in heaviness through manifold temptations." You are in heaviness. This is a feeling of sorrow and grief. You have been grieved, the King James says. You have been distressed, New American Standard. You have been put to grief. For you are troubled, Basic Bible English. Harassed, Phillips New Testament translation. What is Peter saying? He's not denying the reality that there is pain involved in the trial. Pain in the real world. The trial is heavy on the mind. There's pressure on the soul. But keep in mind, Peter says here that it's not going to last forever. He writes, "Though now for a season." Though now for a season. New King James says, "Now for a little while." Basic Bible says, "For a little time." New Jerusalem says, "For a short time." Moffat says, "A passing moment." So what are trials? They're just momentary. In light of the big picture, they're just passing. They're just momentary. And Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 4:17, "For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a more exceeding and eternal weight of glory." The trials that we face in this life for what? What's the life expectancy? 80 years? And first 10 years we don't really face many trials. So let's just say the 60 years we have in this life of testings and trials in comparison to what's out ahead. Come on. And then Peter says, these trials, these testings, these things that we go through, and they can be by people that come into our path. They can be situations that are out of our control and understand, and we can't understand all of it. We can't put it together. Peter says they're mandatory. He writes, though now for a season, if need be. You know this phrase is, if need be. And I'll never forget, I do remember classes when I took from Pastor Stevens in some of his Greek exegesis. But he did have this right. He always said, if need be, and it is. If need be, and it is. That is what the Greek language communicates right here. And the same word is found in Acts 14:22, where Paul was confirming the souls of the disciples, exhorting them to continue in the faith, and that we must, if need be, the word must there, if need be, through much tribulation, enter into the kingdom of God. So yes, it is absolutely necessary. If need be, yes it is. And then he writes in verse 7, in closing, so that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, that's your faith, might be found, your faith might result in praise, honor, and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. So the trial of your faith is so important. In light of what? The big picture. If I don't see the big picture, all these things that are happening to me, it will frustrate me. And I will become an unbeliever. And I will behave like one. But in light of the big picture, our faith needs to be tested. God cannot let an untested faith into the kingdom. God wants to see if we really do believe these things. Are we just playing games with Him? Do you really believe in the judgment to come? Do you really believe that there's a future resurrection? Do you really believe in a coming kingdom with an inheritance? And there's no better way to test than to put us in the hot seat. Various trials are sent to test what? Our belief system. What are we believing? Will the things you believe be able to pull you through and make you a different person? Or will you jump up and down like a little baby in a candy shop that can't get their own way? I want that candy, Mommy! And they jump up and down. That's what God looks down and is like, geez. Gee, what's going on there? I mean, we can really relate to how God feels if you're a parent. You're like, whoa, where's that kind of behavior? Is that? You know what I mean? And God's probably saying the same thing when we do stupid things and talk about stupid stuff. Put our focus on stupid things. It's like, gee, what's going on there? You know what I mean? Where did they learn that from? You know what I mean? Really, and we've all said that as parents. Where did they learn that from? And that's what God probably says. Where in the world did they learn that from? Oh, man. Spurgeon said, a Christian that cannot be tested cannot be trusted. Progress needs to be measured. How can that be done without testing? And Peter says the trial of your faith being much, look at that phrase, much more. Much more. Much more what? Precious than of gold. What is much more precious than gold here? Your faith under test. When someone offends you, that is a test. For goodness sakes, it's a test from God. And what? It's much more precious than having your rights and getting things straightened out. It's much more precious than gold. Gold is the most valuable precious metal on the face of the planet. People have killed over gold. We don't want to ever forget why we're here. That is the big picture that we need to keep in view. God is going to test our faith. And that testing of our faith is more precious than anything in this world. Gold, it has a great worth. It has a great value. I haven't seen it go down in price in a long time. It just continues to go up. But it's temporal. It's temporal. It's not going to carry its value into the next age. It doesn't matter how many bars of gold you have when you wind up at the judgment of God. It doesn't matter. Right? That's what we got to say sometimes to the little things that we fret over. It doesn't matter. You know? In the big picture. What matters is what kind of person are you becoming? I love Psalm 119, 127. Therefore, I love thy commandments above gold. I love thy commandments above gold. Yea, above fine gold. Gold will perish. However, your faith in the trial has greater value, greater worth, because of what it produces in your life. And what it produces in your life will endure to the next age. When Jesus appears a second time, that's what Peter says. Peter says that the trial of your faith will produce a faith that might be found unto or might be found to result in praise, honor, and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. That's the big picture. Praise is recognition. See, it's recognition and approval. I don't need someone's approval here. I don't need when I sit down with two people that are looking for a church. I don't have to tell them, we need you to be in our church, and we are just and hide things from them so they won't know anything about it of our church, so they will come. And that's what pastors are doing. That's what this one pastor did with him. He said, never told him these things. Never told him. Never was up front with him. 11 months he spent there, and finally it all came out. And I said, well, I'll settle everything in 10 minutes, and then you can make your mind up. Because that's what we are. You know, if you don't like us, you'll definitely say this. We're definitely up front with you. All right? If you don't ever come to our church, just remember, we were people that were up front with you. So that's what I told him. Honor anticipates positions. It's talking about rank of placement, and glory speaks of the changing of this vile body that Paul talked about in Philippians 3 to be fashioned like unto Jesus Christ's glorious body. Boy, amazing. Amazing verse. The big picture. Keep the big picture. Keep the big picture. Don't let frivolous nitpicking tear the church or tear friendships apart. Really, don't let it happen. Work on it. Work on your faith. You know? Amen.